these two approaches to model invariance via subfactors and twisted K theory. So I'll first review the subfactor approach, and then what's new in the talk is joint work with Terry Gannon in Edmonton on this twisted K theory approach. Right, so just to be completely concrete, I'll work with one example, the Ising model. So this is just the classical two-dimensional Ising model, where we put a plus or a minus at each vertex of this square lattice. So a typical configuration looks like this. This is one point in configuration space. And that's basically all the data for the Ising model, apart from, of course, the Hamiltonian, which is crucial, the nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. Okay, so suppose we want to generalize this. Instead of having two symbols, we want to have a finite set of symbols with some rules about distributing these symbols on the same lattice. All right, so to do that, it's convenient to reformulate even the Ising model. So instead of playing with two symbols, I'll introduce this dummy variable. And now, for convenience, I'll rotate the lattice through 90 degrees. And now I'll distribute these symbols on this graph. Yeah, 45, yeah. So I'm distributing these on here according to some rule, which is going to give me this. Right, so what have I really done? I've just introduced some edges to this graph. So I've got this Dynkin diagram, or as George would say, Coxeter diagram, A3. I've just distributed the edges of this graph on here, and that's then a typical configuration. Because if I'm forced to use edges of this graph and not, say, from plus to minus, then if I put a star here, then on this graph here, the nearest neighbors of a star down here are plus minus. So I can only go in these directions to minus plus or plus minus. I cannot put a star here. And if I put a star here, I can only move. If I put a plus here, I can only move to a star in these directions. All right. So that means that this configuration is obtained by distributing edges of this Dynkin diagram A3 on here. And I've really just reproduced the Ising model because this is pretty redundant. Except strictly speaking, I've produced two copies of that because I can shift this by one unit. I could start with a star here, and then everything gets shifted. So it's really two copies of the Ising model, which are independent. Okay, but so in some sense, I made things more complicated by going from here to here, but it allows me to generalize to other graphs. So we can go to these A diagrams, which are related to the representation theory of SU2, or their orbifolds. So if I flip around the center, then I'll get this by taking one copy of the points which are moved and bifurcating the point that is fixed. So I get this Dynkin diagram, a D. Okay, and so this all comes from representation theory of SU2, so if we generalize that, we can go on and use graphs like this. So I'm distributing edges of this graph on here, and I'll get models related to SU3, and so on. Okay, and so all this is generalizing my Ising picture, and that enables me to do the following now. So I've got my square lattice, I've got a finite graph, and I distribute the edges on here. And I need something more. I'm going to need some Hamiltonian or some Boltzmann weights. But then I can proceed and take some continuum limits by letting the lattice spacing go to zero. And say, first of all, introduce periodic boundary conditions in one direction and folded up together a torus, possibly with some boundary conditions, and then I fold again and I'll end up with a torus with possibly some defect lines. Right? So I'm starting with a statistical mechanical model. I have a conformal field theory model over here in the limit. And of course the crucial data in all this is the Boltzmann weight. So locally on each small picture here, I have a real number or a Boltzmann weight, the exponential of minus beta of the local Hamiltonian, for each local configuration along the edges. So if I put one edge of my, say, Dinkin diagram here and another one here and along there and there, this number depends on those choices. So I can think of the choice on the left and the choice on the right. So this number depends on two variables. So it's a matrix. It's a matrix depending on the configuration on the left and the configuration on the right. So it's basically a local transfer matrix. And if you're going to get anywhere, you're going to need some integrability coming from the Young-Baxter equation in the sense of some suitable matrix multiplication. So to get solutions to this equation, in other words, sensible Boltzmann weights, you're going to need some algebraic machinery to provide solutions to the Young-Baxter equation. And of course, that's provided by quantum groups. Right, so that's where the SUN theory comes in. So typically, these matrices, these local transfer operators, for the SUN theory, lie in this kind of algebra. Right, so if you think of Q being 1 at the moment, so this is the product action of SUN on matrices, then the fixed point algebra by Weyl duality is generated by permutations of the factors. So in other words, the fixed point algebra is described by certain representations of the symmetric group. And if you introduce a cutoff, so putting in a complex number here, which is a root of unity with some k, this introduces a cutoff into the possible representations of the symmetric group which appear. So that's the cutoff in the Dinkin diagram A to say AK, where the k is this thing here. Right, so the labels which I'm using on the edges here are coming from either the representation theory of the symmetric group or its deformation of the Hecker algebra, or dually from representation theory of SUN. Right, those are the natural labels for putting in here in the original statistical mechanical model from the representation of the Hecker algebra. And actually, in the field theory, what's more natural is the representation theory of SUN, or the loop groups of SUN. Right, so miraculously, if you put one labeling in here, then the other one comes out in the field theory. Okay, so we've then got a number of interpretations of the original vertices of this Dinkin diagram, say A3. All right, so originally they started as the states in the statistical mechanical model, which I was putting at each site here. That was really coming from the representation theory of the symmetric group. And then when I go to the field theory limit, they'll reappear as representations of loop groups. So in the subfactor theory approach, these labels, the vertices of the Dinkin diagrams, or their generalizations, will be bimodules in the type 2 analysis, or endomorphisms in the type 3 analysis. So the bimodules may be more relevant to the Hecker algebra approach, as in Jones-Wenzel factors, and the endomorphisms in type 3, as in the Wasserman analysis of loop group factors. Okay, but they also have other meanings. For example, these plus, minus, and star, they can also be interpreted as specific boundary conditions. In this case, for A3, they would just be plus boundary conditions, minus boundary conditions, or free boundary conditions. They naturally go over to here and there. Okay, and then in the last part of the talk, I'll interpret them again as elements of twisted K-series, so some twisted bundles. Okay, so that means that even in the Ising model, these three vertices represent endomorphisms of some infinite dimensional algebra. So let's see exactly what we mean by that. How can we construct three endomorphisms associated to plus, minus, and star in a natural way from the Ising model? Okay, so I'll show you how to do that. So this all comes about by analyzing the partition function. All right, so the exponential of the sum becomes a product of the local weights. So because it's nearest neighbor, you can analyze it piece by piece as follows. Suppose I instead of taking the whole square or rectangular lattice, let's take a column like this and compute the partition function of this column. All right, so that means that I've got a configuration on the left and a configuration on the right, and I'm computing the partition function. So that's a matrix. So let's call that T. Because it's nearest neighbor, I can decompose the interactions in this way. I can count the weights coming from the interaction along the columns. That'll give me a matrix V. And then the interactions across the rows, I get a matrix W. Okay, so you can actually write these down explicitly in terms of these Pauli matrices. These are non-commutative matrices, and I can, if I take the logarithm, I get this quantum Hamiltonian, which is not Ising. This is much more complicated than this one up here. But at least the matrix T has this fairly simple description in terms of two matrices, V and W. So these numbers, K and L star, depend on the temperature, which I've forgotten to put in. It should be in there, the beta. Right, so at low temperatures, V dominates, and at high temperature, W dominates. And what's important is the eigenspace of the largest eigenvector. It's degenerate in this case, and it's non-degenerate in that case. In this case, 1, 0, and 0, 1 are the largest, and their tensor products are the two largest eigenvectors. Here, it's the random vector, 1, 1. Normalized, which is the largest eigenspace. Okay, so there is some kind of duality between the V and the W, which basically gives me the my endomorphisms. Okay, so in this transfer matrix approach to the Ising model, you decompose the classical configuration space by mapping to this Pauli algebra by this transfer matrix formalism I'm outlining, where over here the dynamics is given by this quantum Hamiltonian, and there's a natural way of taking equilibrium states here to ground states here, ground states of this quantum Hamiltonian. Okay, at zero and infinite temperature, you can write down exactly what these ground states are, because they come from the largest eigenspaces of V and W. So at zero temperature, there's two ground states given by these product states, and at infinite temperature, there's this single ground state given by this totally chaotic vector. Okay, and they are related by an endomorphism nu, which basically just interchanges V and W. Right, that's the interchange of V and W is affected by mapping between these two kinds of Pauli operators. So in other words, if I look here, I claim that there's an endomorphism which maps this to this and the sigma z to the product of the sigma x's. Okay, that's a well-defined endomorphism, not of the whole Pauli algebra, because the sigma z and the product of these sigma x's don't generate the whole Pauli algebra. They only generate half of it. They generate the even part. If I give the Pauli algebra the grading where sigma z is even and sigma x is odd, this is defined on the even part of the Pauli algebra. But I can extend that to the whole Pauli algebra in this way here. There are many ways to extend it. This is one choice. It's basically Jordan-Wigner. Right, so what I've done is I've just taken high temperature, low temperature duality to suggest I write this down. Then I extend to the whole Pauli algebra in this way here. But on the even part, if I iterate nu and take nu squared, then I basically haven't done anything because I'm really interchanging these, except that there is a j goes to j plus 1. There's a shift. So nu squared is the shift on the even algebra. But on the whole Pauli algebra, it is not the shift. I've got this extra term coming in, which seems a bit of a nuisance, but it's actually crucial to understanding exactly what this endomorphism nu is really doing. Okay, so to see that, it's better not to work with the Pauli algebra, but to go one stage further and go up to the Kunz algebra generated by two operators S plus and S minus. Okay, that naturally contains this Pauli algebra. I claim that one way to extend nu, which I've now defined on here, to the whole of the Kunz algebra is by this definition here. I define it on S plus S minus and S plus minus S minus, and that's enough. Okay, so this gives you an endomorphism of the Kunz algebra, which extends what I just wrote down for the Pauli algebra. Now, when you square it now and work inside the Kunz algebra, then you'll find these relations here, at least on S sigma, but the S sigmas generate the Kunz algebra, and the right hand side defines an endomorphism, so this relation actually means this on the whole of the Kunz algebra, as long as alpha here is the automorphism which interchanges plus and minus. Okay, so what this really says is if I decompose the Kunz algebra relative to S plus and S minus, I've got an X in one box and an alpha X in the other. So I've got this decomposition here. Right? So in this way, starting by high temperature, low temperature duality, I've extended from the even part to the Pauli algebra, then to the Kunz algebra, and then this high temperature, low temperature duality is really exactly what I need to get this picture here. So now I associate three endomorphisms to the vertices, the identity, the flip, and this nu here. So there are three they represent the vertices, and the edges mean that if I multiply by the fundamental endomorphism nu, then I can read off multiplication using this graph. So nu times the identity is nu. Nu times alpha, or alpha times nu, is this. And nu times nu is the sum of the nearest neighbors. Right. So the edges describe the multiplication table of the endomorphisms. Okay, so of course, this is a pretty simple model for A3, and in practice you have to do much more than this to get systems of endomorphisms. So I'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, so at least now we're starting to think of this lattice distributing edges here and then taking the field theory. Okay, so to compute in practice, the first thing you do is compute the partition function. So now, if I want to compute the partition function of this local picture, I decompose into strips and compute first the partition function locally. So this will be a T, another T here, and because this configuration matches exactly with that, this is matrix multiplication. So this is some power of T, and if I've got periodic boundary conditions in this direction, I will have to take the trace. Okay, so then when we take the field theory limit, this finite dimensional trace would be some trace on some infinite dimensional Hilbert space associated to the big picture. There'll be two Hamiltonians coming from the two directions. And if we decompose according to some symmetries of this Hilbert space with some lambdas, then this partition function in the field theory will decompose into some quadratic expression like this. Right? And I've used some symmetries to decompose the Hilbert space up here. So that's the label of these lambdas. And so miraculously, they're also the same labels that I started back here, except I now think of them as, say, representations of loop groups. Okay, and then if this is supposed to represent the partition function on a torus, it should not depend on how I parameterize the torus. So it should be invariant under fractional transformations. So that's what I mean by modular invariant. But I can extract from this exactly what I need for that, and that can be described just in terms of this matrix of integers. This is exactly what we mean by a modular invariant. It's something in the commutant of some representation of SL to Z, which is transforming the characters. And because they come from multiplicities of representations, they have to be integers. And usually, because you want uniqueness of the vacuum, there's some normalization like that, but this is a bit of a red herring. So it's often useful to drop this condition. Okay, so I want to understand this through subfactors and twisted K-theories. So the lambdas and the mu's have to be understood, as I suggested, for the Ising model through some endomorphisms with some braiding conditions. So the endomorphisms don't commute, but as sectors they do, so there is some choice of intertwining unitary, which when I write with a crossing satisfies the Young-Baxter braiding fusion and so on. Okay, so we need situations where we can actually construct this. And there are two situations where this is very amenable. Okay, so the first is when we have loop group factors coming from the representation theory of SUN, as analyzed by Anthony. And then we can also get these braided systems of endomorphisms when you take the quantum double of a system, in particular for the finite group. But if you want to get something exotic, you can take the double of the Hogerup subfactor. So if you're going to get something strange, different from loop groups or doubles of finite groups, then that's probably a good place to start. Okay, so in the subfactor approach, you start with a factor n and some system of endomorphisms on that algebra, which are labeled by the vertices of your graph. So then you have to ask, how can we understand the modular invariance? So the simplest modular invariant is the diagonal one. And in some sense, every modular invariant looks like this if you look at it correctly, or at least if you dilate the system. Right, so what I mean by that is, if I start with an original system of endomorphisms on N, suppose I can extend it to some bigger system, in some sense, of endomorphisms on a bigger algebra, which is compatible with the inclusion. And suppose I take the identity modular invariant upstairs, and then restrict downstairs using some branching coefficients. I'd have to be careful what I mean by this in the sense of endomorphisms. But then if I substitute this in this quadratic expression, I will get, in general, non-trivial modular invariants down here. This, in general, will not be diagonal. Okay, so in some sense, at least every physical modular invariant looks like this. The only problem is to find this extension. Okay, so usually we start in the opposite direction. Instead of restricting, we have to induce. Okay, so that's what this process of alpha induction does for you. This induction, this alpha induction, which was developed by Long or Rehren, uses the braiding. So that means that if you use the braiding, there isn't just a single braiding. If you have your crossings like that, there's an equally natural braiding where you reverse everything. So braidings come in pairs. So if there's one induction, a plus one, there's an equally natural minus induction where you reverse all the crossings. So if I can induce, I'll always be able to do it in two ways. So suppose I induce twice using the plus and the minus, using the braiding and the opposite braiding. And then I write down this expression here. This means I take these endomorphisms upstairs, decompose into irreducibles, and then count the number of common sectors. That means what's really important is the blue part, where these things intersect. That's why I write this in blue. It's only the intersection that's really important. And then this is a natural way to get a modular invariant. It's a matrix which commutes with my action of SL2Z back here. And the natural object which you need to classify these modular invariants is a graph which comes from these NM sectors, which you can decompose from these things here. That's basically all I need in the subfactor approach, is this construction through alpha induction and this single graph NM coming from decomposing these into irreducibles. In the SU2 theory, this is the ADE classification. Okay, so maybe I'll skip this. Okay, so right. So on the one hand, I can say that this alpha induction gives me modular invariance. But there are a number of problems. First of all, does this exhaust all modular invariance? And if it doesn't, exactly what class of modular invariance am I constructing? Okay, so. And also, I want to emphasize, it's not important in this theory to normalize my modular invariance to be one on the vacuum. If I allow, instead of subfactors, in other words, having M to be a factor, if I drop the assumption that M is a factor, but this is just an inclusion of algebras, then I can realize modular invariants which are not normalized to be one of the vacuum. And that's significant in something which comes later. Okay, and then there are lots of results about exactly when does this procedure exhaust all modular invariants. So for example, for SUN, it's believed that every modular invariant can be realized in this way. It's certainly not true for orthogonal groups at low levels. And if you want to get examples where there are lots of modular invariants which are not realized by subfactors, then you can go to the quantum doubles of, say, finite groups or Hooker-Upp subfactors. Okay, now let's push this a bit further. So I can induce by alpha induction to plus sectors, minus sectors, and if I just want the moderate invariant, all I need is the blue part. But I can push further and use this to generate more modular invariants by taking products of sectors from the plus, the minus, and decomposing into irreducibles. And that'll build up a much bigger system. This D system here, which is a system of MM sectors, which contains the physical ones, the B ones. Now, these decompositions are related to decomposing the matrices Z, Z star, and Z star, Z into modular invariants. Now, remember, Z being a modular invariant just commutes with SL2Z and has integer entries, and maybe is normalized. Right, so if I take the product of Z with its transpose, then that's another matrix which commutes with SL2Z. It's got integer entries. The only thing that may not happen is that it may not be normalized. And in fact, in general, these squares are not normalized. But you can ask whether you can decompose them into normalized modular invariants. And that decomposition is related to this picture here. Okay, so to see that, I'm going to do some counting. If you count the number of irreducible NM sectors, it's given by the matrix Z. If you count the number of irreducible sectors in this big picture given by D, it's the trace of ZZ star. Okay, so that suggests the following. So suppose I look at ZZ star, that is a modular invariant. It naturally appears in trying to describe the MM sectors. So I should try and realize this by a subfactor. So in other words, suppose I realize Z by a subfactor of N in M, then you can ask if you can realize N by an inclusion into some algebra M tilde, which realizes ZZ star by alpha induction from there to there. Okay, and that can be done. It's similar to the basic construction of Vaughan, except it cannot be exactly that, because in the basic construction, when you iterate, you always end up with a factor. And I don't want to do that here, because this cannot be a factor if this is not normalized. Right, but then I can do some counting. Right, back here, I know that the number of MM sectors is given by this formula as trace ZZ star. And if I look at this inclusion, I will know, using the first formula, that the number of M tilde sectors is given by the trace of this modular invariant. Okay, so in other words, the cardinalities of these sectors have to match. And in fact, they have to match, they do match categorically. It's a natural way of identifying these sectors with these sectors. Okay, so that means that I should really understand this picture in terms of the M tilde sectors. So if I take a central decomposition of M tilde, in other words, if I cut down by a minimal projection in the center here, I will have lots of inclusions of N into a family of factors. They will give me my normalized modular invariance over here. So the central decomposition here gives this decomposition. Okay, and then so this picture should then be interpreted as the classifying graph for this picture, for this modular invariant decomposed according to the eight orbits coming from alpha induction. Okay. So here's an example of one of these decompositions for SU3. In general, a modular invariant need not be symmetric, so it's possible that these two decompositions can be different, even in the number of terms that appear. So such examples do appear. They don't appear for SUN because every known modular invariant for SUN is symmetric. Okay, so that's something about the subfactor approach. I've emphasized these loop group examples. Now I'll go through the K-theory approach, and I'll start with finite groups. Okay, so I'll do it as follows. So suppose we go back and look at these G kernels. So I have a factor n, and I have a mapping from the group into the automorphisms, which is not necessarily a homomorphism, but it is a homomorphism into the outer automorphism group. So there is a correction up to some unitary like this. All right, then associativity will give me some compatibility like this, where this omega is defined by this formula. So it's going to be, first of all, this omega has to be in N, but by compatibility, it has to be in the commutant of N as well. So if I'm assuming N is a factor, this is a scalar. It's a three-core cycle with coefficients in T. All right, and then so from G kernels, I have three-core cycles, and conversely, it's known that every three-core cycle arises in this way. You can even do it within hyperfinite algebras. Okay, that's one thesis. Right, so now let's understand this as follows. When Adrian constructs the quantum double of a system, in particular of a finite group, he writes down these Hom spaces like this, represented by these tubes. Because we're in this very simple case where these Hom spaces are one-dimensional, given by this U, I can decompose this Hom space as complex multiples of a product of one intertwiner U by another intertwiner U star. So in other words, this is a one-dimensional space, or it's a line bundle, which I picture by this tube here, where A is conjugated by H to HAH inverse along the tube. Right, so these tubes represent elements in this Hom space, and this is a very nice cross-section of these bundles. So in other words, if I call T to be this product here, And if I start multiplying them together, composing by another conjugation by k, then I must have that this product is a multiple of this other product, because I'm just playing within one-dimensional spaces. This has to be a scalar multiple of this operator here. And you can actually compute it explicitly as this expression here in terms of this 3 cocycle. So that's my W, which I put in here. Okay, so what this is really telling me is that if I have the following groupoid, if I let G act on itself by conjugation, then I have a projective representation of that groupoid. Right, so this factor here should be thought of as a multiplier for this groupoid. Okay, so if I start off with my 3 cocycle omega here, I end up with an H2 element. This describes this projective representation of G on G. And if you think about that, what that really says is that I have an element of equivariant cohomology of G acting on itself by conjugation, with coefficients in T, but it's H2 instead of the H3 which I started with. And then by the usual dimension reduction, I can go down to this H3 down here. Okay, so in other words, taking these products here is a natural way of going from the Kohn-Jones obstruction to lifting this G kernel, which lies in H3, to an element of H3 of G acting on G, but with coefficients in Z. When I have an H3 element with coefficients in Z, or an H2 element with coefficient in G, I know I've got a Dixmier-Duady invariant. Right, so this means that this is naturally going to give me an element of twisted K-theory. Okay, so let's recall what we mean by twisted K-theory. So we'll just look at twisted K-theory on spaces. So we cannot twist the space, but the K-theory on a space X is the same as the K-theory of maps from X into the compact. And I can certainly twist the compacts by some automorphisms. So we can do some gluing. So I have maps from this space into the compact from this space, and on the intersection I have some gluing given by the automorphisms of the compacts, which is these projective unitaries. So a gluing element is given by an H1 on these intersections taking values in these projective unitaries, which you can identify with this. Okay, so what I did on the previous sheet is giving me naturally an example in the equivariant version of this down here. So I have a graded bundle of compacts. I have an equivariant bundle of compacts, but we can also throw in some gradings where we take account of whether the implementing unitaries are even or odd. That gives an extra degree of freedom in H1 with coefficients in Z2, which is also used in this K-theory approach to modular invariants. Okay, and so the reason this is relevant is that Fried, Hopkins, Telemann identified the Valinda algebra. In other words, the algebra generated by the vertices, or the NN sectors in the subfactor language, as this kind of twisted equivariant K-theory. Right, so in the In the finite group case, it's all very simple. It looks like this. This is what I mean by a twisted element of K-theory. It's just a bundle over G, which is equivariant when I use these line bundles given by these pictures. So there are natural isomorphisms between this vector space, tensor this one-dimensional one, with a transformed one, which is compatible when I compose the tubes. So this isomorphism, or this bundle here, encodes my original three-core cycle. Right? Okay, except that when we do... normally, when you do the quantum double of a finite group, you don't work with G acting on itself by conjugation. You do something slightly different. So the double of the finite group is the subfactor double of the inclusion of, say, M in the cross product of M with G. And the double can be identified with the group subgroup construction for G cross G is the group, and the subgroup is the diagonal group. So the quantum double of G is really this inclusion here. Okay, so that means that what we should do is not work with G acting on G by conjugation, but go to some bigger tubes where I now put in an extra cut here, so I have a left and a right. So I have these one-dimensional tubes which you can write down as intertwiners. And then if my A and B are over here, I transform by H and K by the diagonal action on the left and on the right. So these tubes encode this diagonal action of G on the left and on the right on G cross G. Okay, and then I can look at twisted equivariant K-theory of G cross G, where the diagonal acts on the left and on the right, and I can write down a K-theory for that. And in practice, it's bundles over G cross G which are compatible by tensoring with these line bundles in this way here. Now, as groupoids, the G acting on G and this delta action, the diagonal action on G cross G on the left and on the right, are really the same. So what that really means is that the two K theories I've talked about are really the same. G acting on G by conjugation and this left-right action on G cross G. You can identify the two concretely using line bundles from this kind of picture here. Okay, but the advantage of working with this fancier picture of G cross G here is that I can now change these two subgroups independently very easily, and that's what I need for the subfactor approach. For the twisted K-theory approach here, to modular invariance. Okay, so here I've written down exactly what I mean by an element of twisted K-theory of G cross G. So it's a bundle of vector spaces over G cross G, such that on the left and on the right there are actions given by these co-cycles and this compatibility. If you try and write this out in terms of G acting on G by conjugation, it's much more complicated because you don't have simple expressions like this. You have these huge expressions involving long products of the original co-cycle. Okay, and then I also need the notion of tensoring of bundles. So I can naively tensor the vector spaces, but if I don't do anything more than that, I'll be doubling up the co-cycle. So I have to divide out by this relation here in this algebraic vector space product, and then define the actions on the left and on the right in this way, and then I'll get something which satisfies these axioms. So I need this division to get the correct co-cycle. Okay, and then maybe I'll skip this. Okay, so then as an example, suppose we take the double of S3, which is the simplest non-abelian group, and here's an example which gives the most interesting modular invariant. And then this subgroup gives me a modular invariant which has, in the subfactor approach, some NN, NM, and MM sectors. And in the K-theory approach, I can describe these systems by these twisted K-groups in this way here. So it's convenient to change them one at a time before I make the full change up here. And in this picture, alpha induction, which takes me from bundles here to bundles here, looks like this. And there has to be two of them, given by plus and minus, which comes about as follows. If I take the trivial HH bundle upstairs and then restrict it downstairs, I get a non-trivial bundle down here. I can then tensor with my bundle here using the procedure I just outlined. But so this is my bundle up here. But I have to say what the HH product or what the HH action is on these bundles. And so this has a natural action of H on the left and on the right. So I can actually act on the left, but if I want to act here, I have to interchange these two using the braiding. And that gives me two different results, which work out something like this. Okay, so in this way, you can see plus and minus induction having a left-right structure exactly as it should in this double. Okay, so then that's a fairly toy model, doubles of finite groups. So the interesting work, so this is what I've been doing with Terry Gannon, is to understand the SUN theory through this twisted K theory. So here's an example of two modular invariants, the D4 and the E6, for SU2, which can be described by these conformal inclusions into SU3 and SO5. In other words, if I take the trivial modular invariant here, and the trivial modular invariant here, in other words, the diagonals, and then restrict back to here, I get these non-trivial modular invariants here. This is an example of realizing every modular invariant by a diagonal upstairs. So in that case, it's well known that this goes back to Adrian, that the pictures of the NM and the MM sectors look like this. So now the question is, how can we understand this through twisted K theory? Okay, so maybe I'll skip this. Okay, so this is what we do. We look at SU2 acting on SU3 by conjugation. And then you do an orbit analysis. And then you compute the twisted K-theory of that. And then we claim that we get this picture here. Right, so the main part of the orbit analysis looks at a projective plane like this, which has a Möbius band in the middle, and the boundary of this Möbius band, which is one circle, looks like this. The three fixed points of the action of SU2 and SU3 are here, and then there are the three lines carry these orbit spaces, and so these three fixed points, when I take the relevant K-theory, gives me these three vertices up here. The lines in between on the boundary give me three vertices down there. Then this cap, which fills in the hole in the Möbius band, has a stabilizer, this quaternionic group Q4, and the representation theory of that is used to describe these two vertices here. Okay, so that's a bit interesting, because there are ADE classifications everywhere. One ADE classification is of finite subgroups of SU2. So the finite subgroup of SU2, which corresponds to, which has the ADE labeling corresponding to Q4, is exactly B4. So it's maybe not too surprising that we get this group appearing here when we're trying to describe D4. Okay, so we've also been working on these two examples here. And for example, in the E6 invariant, the subgroup which naturally replaces Q4 seems to be exactly the subgroup of SU2 corresponding to the symbol E6, which is the symmetries of the tetrahedron. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. Sorry? These are just groups, yeah. Yeah, the pair of the groups is the same, yeah. Yeah, that's the advantage of what we're trying to do, is that we don't have to work with the loop groups. We can try and work with the groups themselves. Because the price you pay for this is that the orbit analysis becomes more complicated. I gave a survey in it. No, it's the Institute. Do you want this?
I
have you. Oh, you have to unscrew it.